The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. Jimbo is in Malaysia with 16 of the world's strongest men hurling barrels over walls and such like. So for the next three pods, it's me, Max Rushton, fully armed with minor celebrity anecdotes and hoping beyond hope that my woeful ignorance of European football will not be exposed again. There was some reaction immediately on the blog to me being on. Strange Fear wrote, "Has Max ever borrowed a microwave from anyone slightly famous? That would be a story worth hearing." Pipov says, "Max Rushton is smashing, of course, but I'm devastated not to have Dave Farrar filling in." And it's important to state that Dave is the Brad Friedel to my Michelle Vorm. At least that's how I like to think about it. More importantly on today's pod, the FA Cup. Has the magic that we lost and then got back and then lost come back again? Football hipsters despair as Tim Sherwood outthinks Brendan Rodgers. We continue the outpouring of sympathy for Adam Federici. We ask, can Chelsea win the Premier League? And why was Louis van Gaal such a grumpy puss afterwards? Plus relegation, the Championship, the Scottish Cup and something foreign. I am joined today by two football experts and Barry Glendening. Amy Lawrence is here. How are you, Amy?
I'm well, Max.
You were at Wembley on Saturday.
I was, yeah. I went for the really fascinating of the two games.
John Ashdown is here as well. Hello, John.
Hey, Max. You're right.
Very well. You're trying to drink 500 different types of beer this year, and I'm told that we get a status update every time you come in. What number are you up to?
It's about 160, 162 now, which okay. is... So it's behind slowed
the,
down.
You're behind
it's
the eight down. Ball, really.
Have you got a favourite so far?
I've mentioned a couple of them before, but the Thornbridge Jaipur, which is a very, very nice pale ale. Mm-hmm. And there was a Dark Star Creme Brulee, which was very good as well.
And is it like GCSE coursework and on the day before you've got to hand it in, you're going to have about 260?
Well, at one point I was hoping to get it all done by the end of October so I could have 2 months off basically recovering. Mm-hmm. But now it's looking more and more like New Year's Eve is going to be a bit special.
Do you do that thing with wine where you give it a smell and a swirl around and then swish it around?
I am massively pretentious. Yeah, in fact,
I bet he doesn't spit it into a bucket.
In fact, next Saturday, a friend of mine's, it's his birthday, so we're doing a tour of a pub crawl, but it's not a pub crawl, it's a crawl through some of London's craft breweries. Down on the South Bank.
Quite literal crawl.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
Barry Glendening.
Hello, Max Rushton.
So nice.
Long time no see.
Isn't it? Yeah. Barry Glendening from The Guardian and TalkSport. This should be the final build-up to your marathon, shouldn't it? The marathon that you got a place for and it's next Sunday and then you dropped out because you realised every part of your body is falling apart.
Yeah, that's correct. Just a series of injuries and knack and niggles and a little bit of laziness as well. But, there's a pal of mine who lives around the corner from me. He's doing it on Sunday, and I reckon he has done less than 26 miles worth of training altogether. So I'm my fingers crossed, A, that he won't die, and B, that he'll finish.
Well, I've done it twice, and for everyone that says it's great, it isn't. Right, that's the panel. This is part one. Let's start at Wembley. Aston Villa 2, Liverpool 1. Totally deserved, I think. Did anybody see it coming? Barry?
I didn't see it coming, but I did have a speculative wager on Villa because I didn't think it was out of the question. And as soon as Liverpool went a goal up, I thought, oh, that's it, I've done my money. But Aston Villa played really, really well. I said previously when Tim Sherwood got the job that I thought he might bring through Jack Grealish and Scott Sinclair and make them first team regulars. Hasn't worked out with Sinclair so far, but Jack Grealish, I think, became a man yesterday. It was the best performance of his Villa career. He was man of the match, in my opinion. I think reading some of the stuff about the game, most other people would agree. And him, Christian Benteke and Fabian Delph just wreaked havoc down Liverpool's right-hand side, where Emre Can was switched to right back. after about 25 minutes, I think. And Liverpool had no answers for them at all, and they were instrumental in setting up and scoring both goals.
John, is this about being positive for Tim Sherwood, or is this Brendan Rodgers not being good enough?
I think it's a little bit of both. Yeah, you can't argue with how well Sherwood's done since turning. I think looking at their league form since he's coming in, I mean, they're, you know, mid-table, which is, you know, from where they were, is a massive improvement. Liverpool were just a mess. They were kind of back to early season Liverpool, I thought. And, you know, I think I'm right in saying that the starting 11, everybody in that starting 11, if they'd finished the game, they finished it in a slightly different position from where they started, which you could argue is a sign of flexibility and kind of, you know, on the hoof kind of manoeuvrability. Or you could say it's a bit of a shambles. And, you know, given the result, it has to be a bit of a shambles.
I think your point, Barry, about when Liverpool went 1-0 up, you sort of thought you'd done your money and that was probably that. In some ways, that's what intrigues me most about this Villa performance, that it would have been understandable probably under the circumstances if they had taken that kind of knock of going goal behind, big stage, big event, and found it a bit difficult. But the way that their spirit and their ambition and the way they're enjoying playing propelled them to come back into the game in a style that they've sort of, that seemed absolutely and utterly the antithesis of everything they were about 3 months ago, is for me, phenomenal. I had the dubious pleasure of watching Villa a few weeks ago when Paul Lambert was sort of at the dog end of his tenure, and they got beat 5-0 at Arsenal, and they were absolutely, I remember coming out of the game thinking, God, they're the worst team in the league. And they at that point, they seemed so bereft that even the teams who were in trouble, who were much lower down than they were in the table, who had been struggling for points, Leicester, Burnley, so on, they all looked like better teams than Villa at that point. And to come from such a kind of low scenario, and then it just seems so like such an obvious thing. But if you give players back their belief, you give them something to cling on to and encourage them to express themselves, they each and every one of them look a completely transformed player. Collectively, they're a transformed team.
There was an interesting tweet that came in this morning to you lot saying, will the pod patronise Tim Sherwood again? If you've been doing that for the last few months or not. But the fact is that he actually didn't do too badly at Spurs. He's done very well here. And do people see him as a sort of Harry Redknapp type, or can we give him more credit as a tactical genius?
Well, I think it bothers him as well, because he, in his sort of post-match comments, he's quite often mentioned something tactically that he's done or something positionally. Like yesterday, he was saying that playing two number 10s in Nzogbia and Grealish, he thought that would hurt Liverpool. And yeah, to be fair, he was right. It worked. But you kind of, that perhaps that does get lost a bit in the whole gilet wearing kind of
the bravado.
Yeah. But you need, to be fair, you need both. And, you know, there was no point in somebody coming into Villa trying simply to tinker with things tactically, because they were so completely out of form and out of belief.
I'm just wondering if there's a kind of whole load of people in Germany or something, the hipsters who look at Tim Sherwood and, you know, he's sort of their Jurgen Klopp type, you know. It's a lot of, look at this guy, he's a bit mad, he comes out with these, you know, rah-rah statements and what he's wearing, and he's a bit different and emotional, and isn't it fantastic? I mean, maybe we've got him all wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you can't have one without the other. It doesn't, like, my theory is always that there are plenty of managers lower down the league. You look at somebody like Steve Cotterill at Bristol City, he's somebody that, and, you know, over the years, people like Neil Warnock as well, if you get players to buy into that kind of like up and at him kind of come on lads, let's do it for the team kind of thing, then it can work. But that only lasts so long, because eventually that you just run out of steam.
They're not just doing it on sort of emotion, they're doing it on quality of performance.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Actual technical ability that they played, particularly as you say, that lovely triangle between Delph and Grealish and Benteke, was, you know, someone we were watching with turned around and went, oh God, look, Villa look like Barcelona. And I mean, it was, you know, slightly...
But it was a real intensity, though,
really,
wasn't it?
They really played great stuff, and Liverpool absolutely couldn't cope with it.
How come Liverpool couldn't cope with that?
Look, when they're on a low like this, it's very easy to analyse, and you look at all the things that went wrong. If you go back to pre-season with Liverpool, and the aftermath of Suarez going, and them having to spend that money as best they can, and it wasn't easy spending that money, Who could they have got who was actually out there and available who might have filled that Suarez-shaped hole? Kind of the only one who was available was Alexis Sanchez, and they didn't get him. They missed out. So they sort of did the best they can. Now, you bring in Balotelli, you bring in Ricky Lambert, and Markovic and various others. And if at the beginning of the season all those players work out best case scenario, if Brendan Rodgers manages to bring the best out of all those players, then, you know, Liverpool could have had a rather different situation.
And Sturridge being
and
fit.
Sturridge being fit, exactly. As it's turned out, there's been a lot of worst case scenario things going on at Liverpool. I mean, obviously Balotelli not working out has been a big problem. You know, they were crying out for a centre forward that was going to knit their game together and make it happen. They were unlucky with the offside decision. But Ricky Lambert, to me, is a bit mystifying in that you buy a player who got whatever who you think might get you 15 to 20 Premier League goals, who did really well for Southampton, a big Liverpool supporter. There's all that.
There's a great story around.
It's a great story, and if that had worked, but hey, how many games has he started this season for Liverpool? Not even 10, I don't think. You know, that's not using your resources very well, is it? Somewhere along the line, it hasn't worked out. And Rodgers has to take some responsibility for the players that he identified to try somehow to fill the Suarez-shaped hole. It's left them at the most important period of the season looking lost, really.
I think Rodgers' reputation has took a terrible battering yesterday, and it has done all season. He's hailed as this brilliant young manager. He still hasn't won anything. He won't win anything this season. In matches against the teams above them in the league, Liverpool have taken 4 out of 21 points available this season. They couldn't beat Basel. They couldn't beat Real Madrid. They seem to choke. You know, every time there's a big game, their mentality seems very brittle. And his transfer policies, or his transfers have been largely poor. And all that mumbo-jumbo he comes out with, you know, management speak and marketing speak, just, you know, kind of rubs people up the wrong way as well. So I don't think he has a future at Liverpool, really. He's been there 3 years and he's achieved pretty much nothing.
Well, he did get them back into the Champions League.
Yeah, and they got them straight back out of it by... fielding a B team against Real Madrid, you know.
But and they're still going to finish fifth in all likelihood this season. They've still been to Cup semi-finals. Have they been to two Cup semi-finals?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's... Yeah, they've not won anything, but, you know, it's compared to where they were a few years ago, it's a progress of sorts.
Producer Ben said, should Liverpool upgrade from Rodgers to Klopp? It's the latest Klopp possible rumour.
If they have that opportunity, they'd be mad not to think about it very seriously.
And why wouldn't they have that opportunity? How big's the payoff?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the relationship is with between Rodgers and the owners, and whether it's strong enough to withstand the kind of pressure that there is at the moment. Like you were saying, John, you know, they're not actually a complete disaster area.
They
nearly won the league last year, and then they had to cope with losing the Premier League's best player. And as Tottenham showed a few years ago when they lost Bale, it's incredibly difficult if you're a team who isn't necessarily, you know, amongst the natural order of things in the top one or two, who's losing a player of such importance. Their next season can be just terribly difficult to reshape your team, to integrate the new people that you bring in, to perhaps find a new way of playing. It's just not that easy. And I think Liverpool's major problem was that Sturridge being very in and out, a lot of out this season, particularly in their sort of post-Suarez season, has been made it almost impossible. In fact, if they had, you know, won something, and they do finish in the Champions League, that would be a really big achievement in that perspective.
Let's talk about Arsenal, Reading then. Amy, you were there. Arsene Wenger said Reading were ready to, quote, die on the pitch to get to the FA Cup final. They were on a different planet, motivation-wise, to what he'd seen on tape. Did they want it more than Arsenal?
I don't think so. I'm not even sure some people say Arsenal were a bit complacent. I don't think they were. I think Arsenal made a few key changes in personnel that on the day they got away with it. The fact that probably all four of them weren't great selection choices. Chesney and Goal lacks the kind of confidence that Ospina, the quiet confidence Ospina seems to have, and not only for himself but also for the defence in front of him. I think Arsenal's back four play a little bit differently in front of Chesney than they
did
at Ospina.
It was Chesney's birthday, though, wasn't it? So, you know.
It was his birthday, and he had a nice birthday. They went through.
It was also your birthday.
Well, it was. Yeah, well brought up, Barry. I also had a cup final. I didn't want to mention it.
Yeah, well, I suppose I better. Yes, you won the
Institute of Sport, Education and Health Minor Cup. 2-1 against Winchmore Hill Fives.
Yeah.
We wanted it more than them. So sometimes it works that way.
How do you know you wanted it more than them?
You could just see. You could just see it in their eyes.
See,
yeah.
See the lack
when
of
I got
want.
On the pitch, I change when I cross that white line, Barry. I turn into a raging animal. Anyway.
I see you've also got a black eye.
Yeah. I was coming out of faces late at night.
Right.
It was definitely in the mail online, I'm sure. But Reading played very well, didn't they? I
mean, they did.
And the pain for Federici, and you mentioned it at the top, but almost even more because of the way he ended up with his face in the turf. You know, it was just the worst place he could finish, I think, with that mistake.
It was just a picture of desolation. It was really horrible to see. And even the way he sort of clawed the ball back over the line, knowing that it was so far gone, sort of in this act of sort of desperate hopelessness.
It was almost like an automatic reaction from a goalkeeper. You have to pull it back no matter what happens. But then, even as he did it, he was just overwhelmed by the misery of the whole situation and just sort of collapsed to the turf. Yeah,
and he wept salty tears on his way back through the tunnel to the dressing room.
But you were saying it's patronising of all the players to come out and sympathise with him.
Well, no, I don't think it's... Well, it's nice of them to sympathise with him, but if I was in his position, I think I'd prefer if they just said nothing and left me alone to lick my wounds.
I think that's what he wanted. But in the end, all the players come through and the first question that every journalist threw at them is, oh, have you got a word about
Paul Federici? Yeah, that's fair enough.
So sometimes things get...
I mean, apart from that Rick, he had a very good game. So
you have to feel for the bloke. Gabriel's header was particularly good.
Who's going to win the FA Cup then?
Who wants it more, eh,
well,
Max?
Good.
That'll be your theory.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Arsenal clearly favourites, but I don't know.
I think, if Arsenal play the way they played against Reading and Villa play the way they played against Liverpool, then you know, you'd probably favour Aston Villa, who look much more comfortable overall. But I don't think Arsenal will play quite the same. Look, they had two full-backs who hadn't played for a long time. Debussy looked absolutely knackered in particular. Welbeck played up front, and the difference when Giroud came on for Arsenal was substantial. I think that the only debate for Arsenal is which goalie Wenger will play, because he has this this rule that the second choice goalie always plays in the cup, and last season he stuck with Fabianski right the way through to the final, which was a bit of a surprise. And if he follows the same thing, then Chesney will play. But apart from that, I should think he'll pick the absolute, obviously full strength team, which might be slightly more better balanced than the 11 that started against Reading.
Most importantly, you took your son, and at the FA Cup final, he was very sad because Hull scored twice and he was crying anyway.
That's right.
When Reading scored, were there tears?
Actually, the moment that really reduced him to his little annual outburst was when Ramsey hit the bar, and I think he just saw it all disappearing before his eyes. got a bit emotional again.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome to part two. Let's start at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea 1, Manchester United 0. Everybody, or some people, were very excited about United having 70% possession. Jose said Manchester United's key players were in Chelsea's pockets. And Louis van Gaal said, it was the best match of Manchester United's season. I don't know who to believe.
Well, I've had disagreements with a few people who thought Manchester United played really well. And I'd agree with them up to a point. But They kept possession, they passed the ball around nicely, but were reduced to just taking pot shots from distance. I think only one of which hit the target from Paddy McNair and brought a save out of Thibaut Courtois. And I think that's the only save of any note he had to make in the whole game. And Manchester United will have had a fair idea that Chelsea were going to sit back and let them, you know, invite them to come at them, and they couldn't find a way to get in around or through them. So,
but they had a lot of players out Manchester United, though, didn't they?
They did, yeah. You know, well, I don't know what else to say, really.
just huff a bit more. That point.
No, they played well up to a point, but weren't good enough on the day to beat a Chelsea side that, once again, weren't all that, but did enough to win.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, Buzz. And they played okay, played pretty well. But that's a bit of progression from perhaps where they were certainly last season and perhaps in early bits of this season. So
am I far too pessimistic, or are you very much a glass half full man?
It's a Monday morning, but I'm feeling good.
Okay.
And I think for United, I think it bodes pretty well for next season if they can go to Chelsea and be pretty much on even terms with them. I think that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah. The one thing I didn't take from this game was the quality of dead ball delivery at free kicks and corners from both teams. Was absolutely staggeringly bad.
Another negative point.
Well, yeah, but I just couldn't believe my eyes. I did the minute by minute report, and it's such supposedly, well, they are high quality, excellent players. Can't take corners properly. Very rarely clear the first man. Any of them. I think one corner in the whole game. And that was Angel Di Maria took it when he came on. Quite late, found a team. You know, he found Wayne Rooney with it, and Rooney headed over the bar when he probably should have done a lot better. But yeah, I was just really, and it's not just those teams. I don't want to pick on them, but just throughout the Premier League, the delivery of corners in particular is largely atrocious.
I'm quite a big fan of when opposition fans who are normally stuck up in the corner of a stadium and can't quite see, and not just because of the colour of the ball, celebrate when the ball hasn't gone in. But there's a very good picture of David De Gea turning around when Wayne Rooney put one wide and shouting, "Vamos!" and then having to sheepishly turn around and go, "Oh, it didn't go in."
I thought that was a goal as well. And I was doing the minute-by-minute report, and I had typed goal. You know, I was halfway through typing the score, and then I realised that I was wrong. That could have been a big boo-boo.
An epic fail.
An unforgivable error, Barry. Getting the score wrong in a minute by minute. We should probably talk about Chelsea's goal as well, which was a bit special. Lovely move. And that back heel from Oscar to Hazard. It was just a beautiful goal. And Hazard has to be player of the season.
Nailed on?
I think so.
We can move from Hazard to another person nominated. Talking about Sunday's games briefly, Harry Kane getting the first Spurs player to get to 30 since Lineker, I think. Which I presume we've spent a lot of time on the pod talking about Harry Kane, but he's done very well to get 30 goals in a Spurs shirt, hasn't he?
I think it's a genuinely difficult dilemma about who you would choose for player of the year between Kane and Hazard, because you can make a very good case to say Hazard has been the outstanding performer and deserves extra credit because he's going to be the man as part of the league-winning team. And I always think you have to give extra bonus points to someone when they've been brilliant in a team that wins stuff. But people on the other side of that coin say, well, if you manage to be superb in a team that's not going to win anything, you deserve even more credit. So I can see both sides of the...
That sort of exposes the silliness of individual awards in a team sport anyway. But, you know, it doesn't really matter who wins Player of the Year. But I wouldn't begrudge either of them.
David Gore on Twitter, in regards to Newcastle, who lost at home to Spurs. Barry, do you think Newcastle fans' boycott should continue? Always backed it as a legitimate form of protest.
I don't know what to make of that boycott. I see some of the people who were trying to organise it are hailing it as a success. But when I switched over after the semi-final ended, I couldn't see an empty seat. You know, it looked like the ground was full. Now, as it turns out, the official attendance was given as 47,000. No way it was that high. I think estimates say that between 7,000 and 10,000 people stayed away. You know, that's a lot of people. My hometown in Ireland has a population of 4,500. If everyone left, you know, it would be weird. So it's a valid protest, but and they're entitled to claim it as a victory. And, you know, it's not for me to say whether people should go to the game or stay away. I think the sight of an almost completely empty stadium would have sent, you know, shockwaves around the world in this televised game. And I don't think Mike Ashley would be particularly perturbed, because looking at it from his point of view, you kind of go, well, I can pretty much do anything what I want, and or anything I want, and they'll still turn up, most of them.
I think they have to make their point and generate publicity in whichever way they can.
But I'm not sure why they need to generate publicity. Everyone knows what's happening.
Because they've lost 23 matches at home in the last three seasons.
Everyone knows what's going on at Newcastle. It's not a secret. Like we all know the club has been badly run and it's a mess.
And everybody can sit there and get on with it. Or if you care enough, I'm glad there's people who aren't apathetic. It's easy to be apathetic and think, I've had enough of this. It's more difficult and more challenging to get angry enough to try and do something about it.
But will they achieve, anything?
I don't know. But well, I've certainly paid a bit more attention to it this week. Yeah, like you say, we all know. We've known for donkey's years that it feels like a club that's going...
We've been talking about it on the pod for years. You know, it's not as if everyone's going to go, oh God, I didn't realise Newcastle were a mess and that Mike Ashley was really nasty chairman who the fans don't like.
They have to start somewhere. They've genuinely...
No, good luck to them. I mean, they really do deserve better, a lot better. You know, they...
It's an insight into whether you'd vote for Amy or Barry if they were standing together in an election.
No, but all I'm saying is that, you know, they're raising awareness of something that everyone is already aware of, you know. So I'm not sure how that will help change things, but it's better than doing nothing, as Amy says, certainly.
I guess, if you can't just... If you get to a point where you think, I can't take it anymore, but what else can you do? I mean, you can't... No. Your normal average support hasn't got the money to buy Ashley out or anything like that.
So I guess
it was quite a contrast to John Carver afterwards, who, speaking of sort of slightly defeatist attitude, was talking about, you know, we played well, scored that goal after half time, and unfortunately it woke Spurs up. Which is kind of, I quite like the idea of him on the touchline watching the goal go in and celebrating and going, oh no, that's really going
to
irritate.
Or they have to sort of stealthily celebrate and hope that Spurs didn't notice that they conceded an equaliser. They're 14th Newcastle, 7 points from safety, but second worst defence in the league. They've lost 6 on the bounce. They're not in trouble though, are they? I mean, it'd be very... It would take a lot of defeat.
I think because of that great run Pardew took on them on around about Christmas, I think it was, they've done enough to stay up, even though they are probably as bad, if not worse, than several of the teams below them at the moment.
Should we look at a few of the other sides at the bottom? Leicester City, they've won 3 in a row after only winning 4 all season, beating Swansea 2-0. I don't think they've been playing that badly all season. I think they've actually been playing with quite high intensity and been unlucky in a lot of football matches.
It's extremely weird that Leicester have been, I totally agree with you, they've been really close in a lot of matches and just things haven't gone for them. I mean, when he's not been being a bit bonkers, Nigel Pearson has constantly made the point in his post-match utterings that, you know, how close, we played so well and just didn't get the goal, or we were a bit unlucky. And I don't know why it is that with the pressure suddenly intensified and cranked up, that it's this do or die moment come the end of the season, that they seem to almost be playing with more freedom and just being a bit more ruthless. But they've scored some great goals in the last few weeks, and goals has always been the issue, really. It's turning those moments in games where they've been playing well into goals and points has been the difficulty. But now they've got that habit. They've given themselves a really great chance.
Yeah. He's been aiming quite attacking sides as well, sort of playing three strikers, and they've kind of had that bounce since they sacked him. when you know, and that happens to a club sometimes. You sack the manager, and the inform just improves them automatically afterwards. And so that's what they did. Then they changed their mind and kept the same manager. But it's worked since they sacked him. They've picked up more points than Villa. They picked up more points than Southampton. So
that's the strategy. You just have to sack the manager. You don't actually have to let him go.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can keep him, but sack
him. You
get
new manager syndrome, but with the same clothes.
and they've not got. They've got Burnley next. Burnley lost to Everton, didn't they? Do we write them off yet? Or not?
Well, after what Sunderland did last season, it would be foolish to write off anyone. I thought Burnley had beat Everton at the weekend, I have to say, and they didn't, so they lost. So that it's looking pretty grim for them. But Hull and Sunderland are dreadful. Aston Villa now, players will have one eye on the cup final. So it's easy to see any one, two, or, you know, well, it won't be all three, that's unlikely, of those teams being sucked into the bottom three. So, you know, where there's life, there's hope.
Do you think out of Hull and Sunderland, who do you think is more at risk? Hull have got Palace, Liverpool, Arsenal, Burnley, Spurs and Man United. Sunderland, Stoke, Southampton, Everton, Leicester, Arsenal and Chelsea. So Sunderland really need to get it done before Arsenal and Chelsea, don't they? Away, both of them.
Yeah.
That's a terrible last two games, isn't
although
it?
Chelsea might have won the league. Well, you'd expect they might have won the league by then. Might be a bit more relaxed.
How nervous are you, Barry?
I'm not nervous because I don't care anymore.
You're not going to protest.
You're not angry enough to pay for a ticket and not go to it.
I think a season of the Championship is doing the world of good. I'm just, you know, I'm sick of them scratching around the bottom of the Premier League, getting beaten week in, week out. Players don't care. Why should I care?
Would you rather
I think Jonathan Wilson even is the same. You know, he just doesn't care.
Would you rather be a player winning in the Championship or losing in the Premier League?
How much money would I be on in each?
You're getting around 45 grand a week in either. So, but you have to care about one more than the other and not just buy a Bentley, Barry.
I think I would rather, if I've been beaten, it depends. You know,
have you been beaten for years?
Yeah, have I been beaten week out for years, or have I never been in the Premier League before, you know? But if I was a Sunderland player, I think I'd rather be winning week in, week out in the Championship. Although there is no guarantee Sunderland will win week in, week out in the Championship next season, should they go down. I mean, of the teams there, I think two or three teams are going to be very, very lucky to stay up. And Sunderland might be one of them. I mean, West Brom's win against Crystal Palace on Saturday, I think, was massive for them because they had a brutal run in as well. I think their only other winnable game was against Newcastle. So that they've probably saved themselves now. But yeah, some very bad teams will stay up.
All right, that's part two. In part three, we talk Championship Scotland and the Champions League. Welcome to part three, beginning with a Championship roundup. Has everyone been excited by how tight it is at the top of the Championship? Or, Amy, because you're leaning back, are you thinking, I don't want to talk about this because I'm not following?
I was just deferring entirely to the man on my right here, John Ashdown, who I know is the world expert on all things Championship. So, yeah, of course it's been exciting, but I'll let him fill you in.
John, do you want me to do a little roundup for everybody? Watford are top following their 1-0 win over Birmingham. Bournemouth dropped to second. A point below them after Sheffield Wednesday scored a 95th-minute penalty.
Oh, that was brutal.
Oh, that's a killer, isn't it?
Bournemouth's players looked like they'd just lost the Champions League final. You know, they were absolutely devastated.
I haven't seen it. Was it a Stonewall penalty?
I haven't seen it either, actually.
Has anyone seen it? Let's not ask that question. They have a better goal difference than Middlesbrough, who are level on points after they beat Norwich 1-0 at Carrow Road. And I got in trouble with Middlesbrough fans on Soccer AM on Saturday because I watched that game. We had John Ruddy and Bradley Johnson on. And Middlesbrough did defend absolutely brilliantly. And their keeper may have had a slight thigh injury, but on 88 minutes, he sort of casually caught a ball and then collapsed in agony. And then one of Middlesbrough's centre-backs went down in agony again. And then they substituted Lee Tomlin, who walked off slower than Jack Grealish walked off the Wembley pitch yesterday as well. I mean, it was one of the best sprinting, doing the actions of sprinting, but going very, very slowly to the edge of the pitch. John, take it away then. Tell us, who's your money on?
Well, it's in Watford and Bournemouth's hands after that. It was an ideal result, I thought, for, obviously, it looks Middlesbrough and Norwich playing first Friday night. The other two you think would be hoping for a draw. But I think that Middlesbrough win meant that it was completely in Watford and Bournemouth's hands. They both went into the weekend knowing that three wins out of three would take them up. Watford squeaked home against Birmingham, 1-0 at home. And he hasn't had a lot of credit, actually, Djukanovic there. But given the season or the start of the season that Watford had with three different managers, two of which only managed four and two games apiece, to sort of knit that all together and get them up to 85 points at this stage is pretty damn impressive. And although obviously there's a lot of criticism and sort of slight sort of scepticism about the way that it's been done with the various loan players coming in from the different Pozzo clubs, the player who scored on Saturday was Craig Cathcart, who they brought in from Blackpool last summer. So they're in the box seat, and Bournemouth still, I think, should get over the line despite that gutting 95th minute penalty.
And who of those sides is best prepared for the Premier League?
It's basically impossible to say. I thought last season Leicester. Well, Leicester were so clearly the best side in the Championship last year that I felt that the way that they played lent itself really well to kind of transition to the Premier League. And okay, they're still in with a fighting chance, but they've hardly been clearly the best of the three. Whereas QPR were pretty dismal for big chunks of last season. And they're still in a very similar sort of spot as Leicester, so it's hard to say who can make that transition. I think Bournemouth would have the kind of Burnley style sort of small club fighting sort of us versus them kind of mentality, which could work. And also they've got this sort of weird alchemy that Eddie Howe brings there that just works somehow.
It's a sad moment in life when not just players are younger than you, but managers are younger. It's like Alex Neil at Norwich, when you're not going to make it as a professional footballer because Michael Owen's really good and he's younger than you. But now top managers are younger than me, and that is a real...
Are you feeling like your day is... you're not going to get your day as a manager either now?
I can't kind of cut it in the world of football, no. I should mention Patrick Bamford. He won the Football League Player of the Year yesterday, and he's been brilliant for Middlesbrough, hasn't he? And he's clearly a very good footballer. And we mentioned Harry Kane earlier and the opportunity that he's had at Spurs, mainly because Spurs strikers haven't been very good. And you kind of imagine if Bamford was given a run at Chelsea, he'd probably score a lot of goals.
I think he's deserved it. I think he's, every couple of seasons that he's had on loan in the Championship, he's done enough to warrant that chance. Whether Mourinho will give him that chance is a different question, because it's just not part of his sort of modus operandi, is it really?
It's funny how I was watching Grealish yesterday and it occurred to me, I sort of rather hoped that he had this imaginary conversation, which probably never existed, with Scott Sinclair about, what's it like when you get bought by one of those big clubs? Because I think a lot of Chelsea were included amongst the group who've been looking at Grealish. He signed a new contract with Aston Villa fairly recently. Obviously all the big clubs were looking at him, and I think he had all sorts of options. But you think by staying, if you're in that echelon of clubs who are below the absolute elite sort of Champions League regulars and so on, then you can get that chance that Harry Kane or Grealish or whatever is getting. But if you're at a Chelsea or Man City, it remains. They're playing in the Youth Cup final, aren't they? And there's some fantastic players. You saw Chalobah put in a great performance for Reading on the weekend as well. All these talented guys who were out there on loan. At what point are you going to get your chance?
Were you close enough to Jack Grealish to see if he's wearing incredibly tiny shin pads? Because his socks are by his ankles, but
that's sort of his trademark. That and his boy band quiff.
But does he have little mini shin? Yeah, I know professional footballers wear tiny shin pads.
He wears children's shin pads out of superstition, I think. I don't know what superstition, like some sort of rabbit's foot.
Only valuing a very small part of his shin.
Yeah, he's got a really, really delicate bit of shin down at the bottom there.
I think he's a Villa fan. I know he's a Villa fan from childhood as well, which might...
explain why he wears very tiny shoes.
Exactly. No, which, could help, be a factor in committing to the club. And his dad is his sort of agent and advisor, and he seems to get good advice. I remember speaking, I did an article on him earlier this season. I spoke to the former youth academy director at Villa, and he sort of said that he's very well advised. And he hasn't committed to... He's eligible for England and the Republic of Ireland. I don't think he's committed to either yet. Obviously, Ireland desperately want him. And after yesterday, he'll be very much on the England radar as well.
Certainly. Roy Keane had a pop at his dad, didn't he, not so long ago?
Probably.
but the question about Patrick Bamford is he better than Drogba and Remy,
Drogba looks... In the last couple of games, has looked his age. He's a great player in his day, but it's just, I think he's well over the hill at this stage.
I think he could take encouragement, Bamford, from what's happened to Zuma this year, because it's been like banging a drum for a long time, looking at the young players at Chelsea and wondering where, the next one's going to come through. obviously John Terry seems to be the latest authentic example of a Chelsea youth product who becomes a proper first team player, and that's a blooming long time ago now. So, but Zuma as looks fantastic and has had opportunities and is being properly promoted by Mourinho. I mean, arguably at another club, Zuma might play every week, but I should imagine he's still pretty happy being at Chelsea. They're going to win the league. They're going to get stronger and probably attack the Champions League again next season. And I think he knows he's a part of that. So Bamford has a good opportunity if Mourinho feels that he can trust him in the same way that he feels he could trust Zuma. You know, perhaps he'll bring him in to be a third or fourth choice striker next year.
It's quite an interesting decision facing Bamford, I think, as well. He has got 2 years left on his contract at Chelsea, and he's already in talks about extending that. So it will say something about, you know, what he wants to do with his career, whether, you know, what sort of promises he gets from Mourinho, and you know, surely he's getting to the point now where he must feel like another year on loan in the Championship isn't going to really help him a great deal. So,
well, mate, the other alternative, I suppose, that's possible is he might get a loan in the Premier League, which is not unknown. Again, depending on how much Mourinho trusts what he's got at his disposal vis-à-vis what Bamford might bring or anyone else they might bring in.
Who's going to fill the playoff spots then? Who's the...
Well, if we're going to say Watford and Bournemouth are going to take the top two, then we've got Borough, Norwich, Derby and Ipswich both need to win one out of their last two to get over the line. Derby had a wild 4-4 draw with Huddersfield.
It's proper football that
weekend. Yeah. And
Andy Booth scored all the goals for Huddersfield.
Yeah, Marco Gabbiadini notched for Derby as well. And Ipswich, 1-1 with Wolves, was actually a pretty good result, kept Wolves at sort of arm's length. I think those will be the four,
and it's Wolves or Brentford who are still.
Yeah, they've got half a chance, but they really need Derby and Ipswich to slip up, and the goal difference is slightly in the leading two's favour as well.
At the bottom, Wigan are still just alive, aren't they? But very unlikely they're going to. And that's such a demise for Wigan, isn't it, to go down to?
Yeah, and I'm sure everybody will be sort of thinking, "Oh, what a shame about Wigan tumbling down through the divisions." Yeah, they.
Do you hate Wigan?
Well, everybody has a certain kind of. I've always, I have a chip on my shoulder because I'm a Sheffield United fan, and so any team that I perceive to be a smaller club, you know, in kind of inverted commas, than my team, who have their, you know, days in the sun in the Premier League. Basically, essentially, Wigan and Palace, Stoke, Burnley, QPR, Swansea are all much smaller clubs than my club and therefore don't deserve to be above us in the league pyramid.
Enough chips for a chip butter. Exactly,
yeah. So you're mentioning Wigan, you know, you know you're old when the managers are older than you but are younger than you, but the chairman is only 23 as well, which is bizarre, isn't it? Let's talk about Leeds then. Cellino said he had nothing to do with six players not turning up. Barry, what's going on at Leeds?
Well, like Newcastle, Leeds fans are another set of fans who deserve a lot better than they're getting. On Thursday, Neil Redfern had what he thought was a fully fit squad to go to Charlton. And then before they got on the bus on Friday, six of the players pulled out. Four of them Italians, one Albanian, one French.
I mean, that sounds like my Saturday team. You know? That's ridiculous.
It was announced then that they weren't fit, hadn't travelled, and fans got very upset on Twitter to such an extent that the goalkeeper, Marco Silvestri, tweeted a picture of his injury, which looked like a mild graze on the small of his back, as if maybe he'd got raked by the stud of a football boot, or possibly a lipstick. You know, I've had worse carpet burns.
Don't ask how you got them.
Perhaps he was in a deep pain. I don't know, but it didn't look very serious injury. Mirko Antonucci also defended himself on Twitter because there was speculation that Cellino had ordered, who is suspended from football activity at the moment, had ordered them to go on strike. And I mean, this is just the latest in a series of.
He's denied that, Cellino.
He has since denied it, and Neil Redfern said it was a series of freakish events that caused the six to miss the game. And Neil Redfern, there have been other mad things going on, far too many to list in total at Leeds this season, and this is the latest. But like a few weeks ago, Neil Redfern's assistant, Steve Thompson, was fired for reasons that remain shrouded in mystery. They signed a player, Zan Benedučić, from Milan, and it now emerges that apparently they were advised not to because by their medical team, because he has a dodgy knee. So they signed him anyway, and then he went on to have a knee operation. Steve Morrison, who's a striker with Leeds, hasn't been in the team lately, hasn't even been in the squad, you know, spends his match days training at there's Thorpe Arch, the training ground. He said that he's never seen anything like it in football. And of the six guys pulling out, he just said that people can draw their own conclusions about what happened. And Chiellino claimed in an interview in The Sun, I think it was on Saturday, he said, "From day one, I felt I was at the right club because I am, and pardon my French, more fucked up than the fans," which is just an extraordinary thing to say. So, I mean, it's a circus there, and who knows. Redfern has done unbelievably well to keep them up amid all that chaos. His contract is up in summer, and they reckon it won't be renewed either. So,
and do we have any idea what will happen in the summer?
I have no idea what will happen this afternoon, tomorrow. You know, it's anything could happen. It is bonkers. I think Chiellino has said he's going to ask for permission to go to their last game of the season at Rotherham, and I'd say in the interest of his own personal safety, you'd hope he probably doesn't get it.
We should just say well done to Bristol City and to Burton as well, promoted from League Two, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, their manager, who just trains them in kicking the ball really hard, and that's how they've scored all their goals. We've got 5 minutes to talk about Europe. Should we look ahead to the Champions League second legs? Barca 3-1 up as they host PSG. They warmed up with a 2-0 win at home to Valencia. Suarez scored after 55 seconds. Messi's 46th goal of the season. Zlatan is back for the second leg, but can anyone see PSG doing that, even with Zlatan?
No.
Nope.
Possibly, if they get an early goal.
OK, Gareth Bale, Luka Modric, doubts for Real's game with Atletico. Now, they were injured in a 3-1 win over Malaga. This is their eighth meeting of the season. Atletico are unbeaten in all those games. 0-0 the first leg, which was pretty relentless. Thoughts, again in brief, on this one. But maybe not quite as brief as those previous answers.
I just hope it's a better game than the first leg, which was dreadful.
I thought it was quite a good game.
I enjoyed
game.
It.
Did you?
Mm.
God, I thought it was awful.
There you go.
I don't know. Maybe I'm going to have to revise my opinions on everything. I'd personally quite like to see Atletico beat them, but I just want a good game.
Yeah, I'd go along with that.
I think Atletico have got a few problems as well with players missing. So I think fullbacks in particular. So that could be a avenue that I think Real Madrid will be going for. I'd sort of, despite Atletico's good run of results, avoiding defeat against Real Madrid this season, you'd like to think that they can somehow get a payback for the final of last season, where they looked like winning it until so very late on.
The first leg did just look like a massive fight waiting to happen.
I mean, it's quite riveting in its intensity, but I sort of expect Real Madrid to do it, but it's too close to really judge.
Juve have a 1-0 lead as they go to Monaco, and Bayern are in disarray after losing at Porto. The club doctor, Hans Wilhelm Müller-Wolfhardt, resigned after 38 years in the role. Has anyone read about his strange techniques of sort of goat placenta? He's that kind of doctor.
Does he put blocks of cheese on injuries?
Felix Magath style.
They should give him a job at Leeds.
It seems strange, though, to get rid of your doctor, doesn't
it? Well, didn't he?
Yeah, he quit.
He quit, but I think he quit in a huff because Pep Guardiola sort of blamed him for their defeat at the hands of Porto.
Yeah, there's some footage of Guardiola sort of sarcastically, looking like he's sarcastically clapping the club doctor after, I think it's a game against Mönchengladbach, and somebody goes down with an injury, and it looks awful. Like, he turns around and just starts clapping in this poor guy's face, basically. And you wonder if it's kind of slightly because of the perspective, if he's actually just sort of annoyedly clapping his hands together. But it genuinely looks like he's being sarcastic.
They're missing a lot of players. I mean, they've got a lot of injured players.
I think they're injured.
Is that the doctor's
trouble, fault?
Or is that just, I mean, that's sort of bad. Arsenal have this, don't they? What's going on at Arsenal?
Arsenal don't have this now, you see.
What happened?
But bizarrely, because I wrote this piece which got, you know, joyously shoved back in my face earlier on in the season about Arsenal brought one of the guys who'd been working with the German World Cup squad. There's a bunch of Americans who are world experts in what they call performance culture. And they've been working with the German national team for a decade, and exactly the decade that's sort of coincided with the revival of German football, which culminated in the World Cup win in the summer. And I had a long interview with a few guys who are connected with this performance culture team and what they do, and some of it is unbelievably detailed. I mean, obviously they're trying to be at the forefront of all sorts of science and nutrition and various things, such as they have a look at how a player runs and their gait, and if they can see that by the way that they run, which is obviously something you learn as a child or a toddler when you start running, you're not taught how to run in a specific way, you might be running in a way that's slightly puts overloads pressure on your left calf muscle or whatever.
Don't you do that when you buy a pair
of
trainers from Runner's Need? You do that, don't you?
Well, I don't know. But anyway, to cut a long story short, Arsenal got in one of these guys because they obviously had massive problems, and there'd been a big inquest into their repeated mass injury situations. And at the beginning of this season, lo and behold, everyone was getting injured all the time, and people went, it shows what you say, that there's going to be this big change, and that arguably Arsenal's most important signing was this guy that came in on the medical side. And actually, they have got, fitness-wise, Arsenal, they're the best they've ever been at this stage of the season for donkey's years. So maybe it's... I mean, these things don't always change overnight, but the regimes that they've had, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, they've only really got Oxlade-Chamberlain injured at the moment. And to only have one of their top players out and to be quite low on that physio room list of league table of injuries, that's an extraordinary change. So maybe Bayern need to work with the German national team guys instead of their local guy who's been there for 3 years.
I heard that Dave Brailsford at Team Sky teaches everybody how to wash their hands. Like, it's that specific, because some people don't know how to wash their hands and might pass on diseases.
That wouldn't surprise me.
That's attention to detail that I wouldn't have.
Mm. I'd like to know how to. Now I'm worried that I'm not washing my hands properly.
There must be a YouTube tutorial, which we'll find and add it. We'll put a link to it.
I think a lot of people tend to neglect between their fingers, you know. So I would imagine doctors, surgeons probably have to get those lessons on how to wash their hands.
They've got those, you know, those things, don't they? The that sort of gel on every doorway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got a friend who, I don't know if it's connected, I reckon. So he makes whenever he goes to a public toilet, he makes himself a paper toilet seat out of squares of toilet roll.
Oh, no.
I wonder if Brailsford, maybe he's heard something from some Team Sky. So it's not just the hand washing, it's the entire process of going to the loo.
But, how many men do you see not wash their hands? Just adults in the office, even in The Guardian. I'm sure that, yeah, don't gasp, Barry. You'll see men not washing their hands.
Yeah, all the time I see it, yeah.
Is it the same? I think women are probably better at that. But I'd hate to get told off for being, you know, stereotyping.
I wouldn't really wish to speak for my gender on hand washing.
But you'd lay out toilets, roll? Or
no, I haven't done the laying out toilet thing. I mean, obviously, if you go to a particularly unpleasant looking toilet, you'd probably sort of squat so you don't have to have the bodily contact with the seat, would be the female.
Those germs
approach.
Can jump, Amy.
I had a friend called Andy Law who didn't realise until he was 22 that the toilet seat was for men as well as women, and he would just sit on the bowl. Seriously, because it's not a conversation
called porcelain.
It's not the conversation that you normally have,
right?
Is it? The worst thing you can do is start a conversation just before someone puts their hand in the Dyson Airblade, because you can never hear what they're saying, and then you've got that awkward. Do you wait or not? Are we going to keep going on this, or have we had enough now? Producer Ben wants a prediction on which one. Just on Porto Bayern, you want a prediction. For some reason, we need a prediction on the Porto Bayern game. Please tell us, Barry.
I think Porto will go through. All the stats are against Bayern, even though they've won 4 at home in Europe this season, scoring 13. But 7 of those were against one team in one game.
John?
Yeah, I agree with Bass. The first leg, they were the better side. They worked out a way of playing against Bayern. They really rattled them, and they've got tons of attacking talent there. So, yeah, Porto in the semis, I reckon.
Amy Lawrence.
I am going for Bayern 3, Porto 1, and extra time.
And that's what we all want, ooh, isn't it? Oh, well, thank you for your time, everybody. On what is it, Barry?
The Fit Bar. I was told to swat up my Fit Bar.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And that's all for now because Barry had done lots of... Barry, this is like a coda, isn't it?
We get criticised for neglecting Scottish football and then when we do address it, we get things wrong. So I'd be very careful. I even watched one of these games and it was very exciting.
So this is the Scottish Cup, isn't
Scottish
it?
Cup, semi-finals. Saturday, Hibs and Falkirk from the Championship took each other on. Hibs had all the play and got basically knocked out by a Falkirk sucker punch. Hibs had Craig Sybil headed in across from Blair Aston. And Hibs boss Alan Stubbs, formerly of Everton and Celtic, he was very upset and said that only one team deserved to win the game and it wasn't Falkirk. So his opposite number, Peter Houston, slapped him down in fine style by criticising Hibbs's inability to defend crosses into the box and by pointing out that I think it's in 5 games they've played this season, Falkirk have won 4 and are unbeaten against Hibs. So Falkirk into the final then.
It's just so strange hearing you talk about football, Barry.
Sorry, yes.
It's okay.
I feel like we should be sort of singing the countdown clock in the background.
and
then on Sunday, Inverness Caledonian Thistle took on their fellow SPL side Celtic at Hampden Park. Celtic were a goal up when Josh Meekings from Cali stopped a goal-bound shot with his hand. Now, it was quite blatant, and there was a goal-line official
staring at it, literally
like
staring
5 yards
it, yeah,
away, staring at him. And still him, the referee, and the goal-line official. Now, we don't know for certain that the goal-line official didn't buzz the ref, and the ref, you know, chose not to take his advice. But, yeah, it was inexplicable how that goal was disallowed. So that would have put Celtic... probably 2-0 up. Chris Commons doesn't miss many penalties, and Cali would have been a man down because he was worthy of a straight red. But they got away with it, and then Greg Tansey equalised for Cali, and then in added time they went ahead. John Gaudetti equalised for Celtic, and David Raisin scored late doors for Cali to put them through to the final. Now, this final is going to be quite interesting. Falkirk haven't won since 1957. I don't think Cali have ever won it. But I just checked. The average attendance for Falkirk is 4,500. And the average attendance for Cali is... 3,800. And the capacity of Hampden Park, where the final is being played, is 52,063.
Yeah, but they'll fill it.
Well, hopefully.
We took 20,000 to Wembley for the playoffs. Hmm? We don't average that, yeah. Cambridge.
I'm sure other people will go, but I don't actually know how big Falkirk and Inverness are. How big are the respective populations? Does anyone have a clue?
It's a great question. And now we're going to get told off again for
for not knowing the population of Inverness.
Populations of Scottish towns.
I will have the census figures for Falkirk and Inverness on Thursday. So stay tuned. If that doesn't get them back, nothing will.
So we'll have that. Simon Burton and Ian McIntosh. John, thanks for your time.
Cheers.
Amy, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
We'll see you on Thursday.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.